get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we want to continue talking about Mr. Trump, but we want to do it in historical perspective. We want to step back and we want to look at, you know, where does he fit in this a long evolution of the radical right linked up with corporate America? Because that's what he represents. He's not a new phenomenon. He's just the latest, the repackaging of that phenomenon. And it's good to step back a little bit and look at it in historical perspective here, because that'll give us some idea where things may be going. I also want to remind you, if you are interested, I wrote a piece back right after the election in November saying Taming Trump, because I've believe they will tame him, and we already see signs of that beginning to occur. When I say they, I mean the corporate elites and their political representatives in the seats of government and the state apparatus. They will tame him. They're on the way of doing it. We can see it. We may come back to that theme when it becomes a little clearer, but we can already see it. You know, he's not opposed totally to trade, free trade. He's a bilateral free trader, not a multilateral. And, you know, on one hand, he attacks Mexico and says things about Germany and China. But he embraces Canadians and Japanese, you know, big hug fest, invites their presidents and prime ministers over, and has a nice hug fest with them. So apparently they're not on the list, although we run a huge deficit with them, trade deficit with both of them. But, you know, the enemy is Mexico here and China, although he's going slow carefully on China because China can bite back big time. So, you know, he's backtracking on the trade thing. There are other items, it looks like on the taxes, he's backtracking on giving the middle class tax credits. That fight's going on. Russia, you know, he's backing off of all the praise of Russia and Putin here, and His cabinet people are running all over Europe trying to placate the European elites that, no, we're not going to give up on NATO, et cetera, et cetera. So there are signs. And I'll see if maybe PRN will go ahead and post that article that I wrote, how they're going to go about getting Trump and put him back in line here. The emoluments clause of the Constitution is probably right up there as one of the techniques. The deep state, you know, the intelligence apparatus is pushing back real hard. The mainstream corporate press is pushing back real hard. And his speech earlier in the week here to Congress gave some signs of softening. He'll keep tweeting and talking the talk as a radical right populist, but watch what he does. And I think it'll be two Trumps here. We'll see two Trumps. Anyway, we'll maybe talk about his speech a little bit after, but I want to talk about putting him in historical perspective here first. Before we do that, though, I have one other comment I want to make. I just have to make this. It has to do with Obama. And news this past week, Obama just signed a very lucrative deal for a book, reportedly worth $60 million. Yeah, $60 million. More than $60 million. Wow. That's with Random House, okay? What does this represent? Well, this is how those who deliver the goods for the corporate elite in this country get rewarded. You see, they don't have to be corrupted, you know, in a gross, crude fashion. I mean, like, you know, tin pot South American generals who put their hands in the till and just take what they want. No, we don't do that here in the U.S. It's all legal. Corruption is legal. Yes, and how do we pay people off who do a job for them? Well, we sign book deals, you know, multi-million-dollar book deals, and we set up a series of speeches, you know, to different corporations and trade groups and so forth, police associations, et cetera, and we pay them hundreds of thousands of dollars a speech. Well, we saw that that was how Bill Clinton made his millions immediately after he left office, right? And then Hillary picked up on that and was making millions, going tens of millions, going around giving speeches for $250,000 each. So these are the two favorite ways. There are a lot of other ways of credits and low loans, you know, to build their presidential libraries and, you know, contributions to the libraries, and then they pay themselves a salary from the library, et cetera. There's lots of ways that are legally they get rewarded. You know, Ronald Reagan, when he left office, they corporate America, arranged to for him to give a 10-minute speech, and they paid him $6 million for the 10-minute speech. Oh, you didn't hear about that? No, because it was arranged to be given in Tokyo. Yeah, it was so blatant and obvious that they arranged the speech, and who paid for it? Well, American corporations paid for it, and wealthy investors paid for it, and the Japanese didn't pay for it. So that's one of the most egregious examples. Well, $6 million, you know, it's a jump change compared to how they pay them off now. Not just presidents, of course. You know, the lower you are down on the ladder of political elites here, you know, the less you get. If you're Ben Bernanke, the former chair of the Federal Reserve, who arranged virtual no-interest loans for bankers for 6 years here, and corporations, right? Because the virtual low-interest loans meant that corporations could float bonds and pay very little for them. And we had this incredible corporate bond boom that's still going on, worth trillions and trillions of dollars, at least $6, $7 trillion since 2009. Well, that's money in the pocket of non-banks as well. So it's not just the banks got to borrow from the Federal Reserve for virtually, 1/10 of 1%, 1/4 of 1% for years and years and years, which meant grandma and grandpa on their fixed incomes didn't get any interest. So it was just a transfer from grandma and grandpa to the bankers. Ben Bernanke goes around now and nicely is paid $200,000 a speech. Well, that's how they take care of their folks, you see. And this latest book signing deal by Obama is just the beginning. You know, they're going to print 3 million copies. And if they don't sell them all off, you know, there's what happens is that corporations step in and buy up the residuals. So the publisher knows that. Random House knows that they'll sell the 3 million. So that's how we reward those who deliver the goods here for the ruling elite and big corporations and bankers in this country. It's all legal, all above board. They don't have to do criminal fraud. It's all legal. Okay, so just wanted to say that before moving on to talking about Trump in historical perspective. Also an announcement, in coming weeks, I'm going to have some guests on. We're going to talk about the discussions going on vigorously at the grassroots here among union activists about what can be done, what should be done here different, because it looks pretty clear that the labor unions are about to disappear virtually here. So a lot of folks are talking about a whole new strategy. You know, of course, the union strategy has for decades been a kiss up to the Democratic Party. Maybe they'll throw you a few crumbs, right? We saw that with Obama, right? Labor backs Obama in 2008, delivers the vote in the industrial states in 2012 that put him over one more time, right? That vote and Latinos turning out for him one more time, and other and women minority groups. That's what put him over Obama in his second term. You know, he didn't win that as dramatically as he did in 2008. Everyone would vote for anybody in 2008, but in 2012, you know, give me one more chance. And they gave him one more chance, and it was the industrial working class, along with Latinos, who turned those swing states, electoral votes in the swing states in the Midwest, and Latinos helping and turning Colorado and Virginia and other places like that. And that put Obama over one more time. And then, of course, you know, that was the last time the industrial white working class and the Midwest was going to fall for that. And we saw how they flipped and voted and gave just enough margin to Trump in 2016 here, okay? So there will be some discussions with representatives of people, you know, union folks, organizers, and so forth that we're going to have on, you know, what's next for labor? Which way for labor? You know, can they just keep hiding under the skirts of the Democratic Party, who can't deliver anything anymore? You know, Obama promised to deliver a card check when he ran in 2008. That was to help unions overcome all this moneyed interest that prevent union organizing by just letting them sign people up who wanted to join the union. That didn't even get the first base under Obama in the first 2 years, even though he had a big majority in Congress in both houses, didn't do anything. And that's going to be interesting to see how aggressively, by the way, Trump and the Republicans do with you know, their control of Congress and the presidency. Well, Obama was in the same situation in 2008 to 2010. He had 2 years. He could have done anything he wanted. But he went slow. He was careful. He listened to his banker advisors like Larry Summers and other ones saying, oh, we can't spend that much. We can't give the middle class tax cuts. It's got to be business tax cuts. And that was Larry Summers. And he listened to him. I mean, even Democrats in Congress wanted to be more generous on consumer household tax cuts. And Summers says, no, it's got to be business tax cuts. So he gave $300 billion almost to business, and they just sat on it. Well, that was Obama's first 2 years. You know, historically, a real blown opportunity. And we'll look back on that as the turning point, those first 2 years of Obama's regime, because if he had done what he could have done, we would have had a more robust and earlier recovery, and we would not have had people so desperate after 8 years of Obama wanting anything but. And then, you know, they give us Hillary, which was a step back from even Obama, right? So, you know, Democrats, some big, big errors, strategic errors here in the last 8 years, and then they keep making those errors, you know, squeezing out Sanders, who could have won easily if they weren't opposed by the elite, the corporate wing elite in the Democratic Party, you know, the former faction called the Democratic Leadership Conference that took over in the early 90s and put their boy Clinton in. And ever since then, you know, that corporate wing, that donor wing, big money wing, has dominated the Democratic Party, pushed the party into, you know, free trade, and we know where that led them. Yeah, and then, you know, we have, it looks like the continuation of the same, doesn't it? Because they just had a fight within the Democratic Party for who was going to lead the Democratic National Committee, the leadership, right? And it was this guy Ellison that the Sandinistas and others wanted in there, the progressive wing, versus this Perez, who was, you know, in the cabinet of Obama. And guess who won? Yeah, Perez won, right? So it's the same old corporate wing dominating the Democratic Party here. I don't care what they say and all the nice words and so forth. It's going to be that wing for another at least two to four years, which means Democrats aren't going anywhere. So a lot of people in the union movement are saying, gee, more of the same. We're going to have to maybe figure out something else to do. Well, anyway, we'll have these folks on in some discussions in the coming weeks, and I'll have promo announcements on PRN here indicating when to actually come out. We're going to follow as well these French elections. Well, actually, the Dutch elections are coming up first here next month, then the French elections. And in both cases, the Trump-like radical right parties are leading in the popular polls. This guy Wilders in Holland is leading, they're really anti-immigrant, and a whole bunch of other populist right positions. You know, this whole right-wing populism is taking root in lots of places. You know, Poland and Hungary and elsewhere, in Romania, it seems to be gaining momentum within Europe. If Wilders in Holland and Marine Le Pen in France win those elections, well, it's a whole new ball game, right? And we'll see how that turns out. Well, right now they're both winning, and after that, of course, Italy will have elections, and you know they'll go the way France goes. And then Germany in September has elections, and the SPD, Socialist Party in Germany, in order to prevent this rightward populist swing with other parties there, like the Alternative for Germany Party, has moved out, it looks like, of the coalition with the Conservatives and Angela Merkel, and is going to contend that election. That will be very interesting to see whether the SPD, kind of a left Democratic Party, can capture the imagination and prevent popular sentiment from flowing further right in Germany as well. Because when it flows right in Germany, we know what happens. Okay, so that's what I want to say on topics and issues other than the main topic here today, which is Trump in historical perspective from Nixon to Breitbart. Just published an article on this. You can read it in Counterpunch today, or you can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. It's a lengthy piece that compares the policies and strategies of Nixon and Reagan and Contract with America, Gingrich and his boys in 1994, and the Tea Party, and shows how Trump is basically just the inheritor of that whole trend. You know, the Nixon connection, not just Nixon, but all of it, represents this deepening corporate alliance with the radical right and the transformation of corporate politics with the radical right here. So we got a split in the ruling elites in this country, and that's how you should see what's going on with Trump and those going after him and so forth. You know, the deep state going after him, the East Coast media going after him. Some people in his own party going after him, of course, the Democrats. But yet he has his own base, and that base has corporate and wealthy elements behind him as well. The fight here is really about a fight between these two wings, and it's not really fascism versus democracy. That's nonsense. You know, Trump is certainly authoritarian and dangerous and doing some fascist-like things in early stages, but it's still mostly talk. Trump is not a fascist. People don't understand what fascism is when they say that. They think, you know, just because authoritarian and right-wing, that's fascism. No, no. Maybe we'll have a discussion here, you know, what really is fascism and how much does Trump represent that trend. But it's not that. Okay. So it's really a fight between the wings, really. And that's how it should be be understood, right? Okay, so when I say Trump in his historical perspective, you know, the antecedents and policies and strategy to Trump are Nixon, Reagan, and the contract with America, Gingrich's movement in Congress at the time in 1994, right? Of course, there are new elements to this mix, right? Trump has integrated the leftover Tea Party forces that were purged by the Republican Party elite after the 2012 national elections. You know, the Tea Party was deepening its position in the Republican Party and was winning nominations to run for Congress and, you know, different positions, state level and so forth. And they weren't very clever in their campaigns, and they were getting defeated. So the Republican Party establishment, together with the Chamber of Commerce, developed a strategy to prevent the more radical elements of the Tea Party from getting Republican nominations, you know, kind of a purge. Those who were reliable and willing to go along with the elites became more or less became the so-called, I think it's called the Freedom Caucus in the House. But it's tamed compared to some of the Tea Party. Well, Trump has reunited this group, you know, within his movement. He's also brought in some of the more aggressive elements of finance capital, you know, hedge funds, commercial real estate, private equity, security speculators, so forth. People like the Adelsons, the Singers, the Mercers, the Schwartzmans. They're part of his new wing. And he's captured, for the moment at least, important elements of the white industrial working class in the Midwest and South. He's co-opted union leaders from the building trades. You know, he brings them in the building trades, the construction unions, brings them into the White House. You know, they walk around, gaga. You know, I'm in the White House. Oh, wow, you know. And, you know, courts their egos, and it's easy. They're like little puppies. They roll right over, you know, pet me, pet me. But he's even neutralized some union leaders in manufacturing industries with his fake promises of a new manufacturing renaissance in the U.S., right? And, of course, he's got the gun lobby, the NRA, the religious right, and now he's added the Breitbart propaganda machine and some elements, although he keeps them a little afar of the alt-right fringe. You know, this is the new base. This is the new alliances that he's put together here that has been proven successful for him. You know, and the established Republican elites, you know, the Paul Ryans and the McConnells and all those in Congress, you know, you see sort of out there. And they're very uncomfortable with him. But they see an opportunity with him to really deliver for their corporate contributors with tax cuts and deregulation, right? And as long as he doesn't go off the reservation with free trade and stays with free trade, they can live with him as long as it's bilateral free trade, not multilateral. So that's the new movement here. He's got his base, right? And Trump should be seeing this new base and this movement as a reaction to the crisis of the 21st century. You know, we got a growth in financial assets incredibly, but real growth has been slowing down. Real growth meaning real investment, you know, particularly in the U.S. in gross private domestic investment in buildings and structures and equipment and factories and all of that has been declining. Capital expenditures have been declining. And with it, surprise, surprise, productivity has been declining. I mean, you can't have productivity gains without that. And the jobs we've been creating, you know, 90% of them have been what's called alternative jobs, part-time temp jobs, independent contractor jobs, contingent jobs, low-paid service jobs, not full-time, without benefits. And gig jobs, gig economy jobs now, where capitalists don't even have to provide equipment and machinery. They get the workers to pay for that. Yeah. That's what the gig economy is, super exploitation, gig economy. So, we got this crisis of no growth. That's why we see, despite 8 years of low interest rates, virtual zero interest rates by the Fed, we see very little growth. We see growth in profits and in capital incomes because we've cut taxes so much on capital incomes and on our corporate income tax has been slashed in a number of ways, you know, somewhere between $8-9 trillion given to corporations and investors under Bush and Obama. And now, of course, Trump wants to give them another $6 trillion more. So a lot of the profit growth is not because businesses are selling more goods and services to us. You know, it's not that there's growth, more things are being produced and therefore sold. No, no, that's not the source of these profits. It's cutting the cost. You see, you cut interest rates to zero, you cut business cost, right? You deregulate, you cut business cost. You change the nature of the labor market. So, you know, you privatize pensions and health care and so forth. You cut business costs. You allow businesses to shift the cost of health insurance, those who still have it, onto their workers. You cut business costs. There's lots of ways they've been cutting business costs here in the last 16 years, and that's what's really pumped up the profits, you see. The profits being measured in profit margins, that means profits on as a percent of operating costs, right? Reduce operating costs, boost your profits. Not sell more, and certainly it's not selling more at higher prices because the slow growth has meant virtual no price increases, and nearly deflation here in the U.S. and deflation, of course, in Japan and Europe, because this phenomenon is not just here in the U.S. So these huge increases in profits, also, you know, you keep interest rates so low, and businesses turn to financial speculation and financial asset investment instead of real investment. You know, building buildings and factories and offices and equipment and so forth, right? Instead, people are, you know, with money are investing in stocks and bonds and derivatives and currencies and so forth, right? That's how they're making a lot of their money. So we have this huge profit boom in the last 8 years, but it's all gone to, you know, the 1% in their corporations. And in fact, as I've said before, studies by the University of California show that 95% of all the income from economic growth since 2009 have gone to the wealthiest 1%. 95%. Okay, I've said that before, but it's worth saying again, right? Because it shows you that all the growth has been in capital incomes. Has gone to capital incomes, but that's because of the nature of the profits, which get then passed through to the shareholders as you cut dividends and capital gains and so on. Right, you just pass it all through. Corporations are the conduit for the wealth for the 1%, and if you cut the taxes on that, you cut business cost, right? You cut business costs on business taxes. You cut capital gains, personal income taxes, you know, that $8-9 trillion I'm talking about. And it passes through and, it becomes, big income gains, 95%. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that, that's how these profits have been boosted. And then corporations turn around and they buy back their stock. By the way, this big run-up recently here this week in the stock market, a lot of it is buybacks, right? That's what's going on, anticipating that the Fed is going to now truly start raising interest rates. That means it's going to take the stock market is going to take a hit once it really happens. When that happens, you know, the stock buyback movement driving the stock market is going to slow down. Okay, so we're talking about Trump in historical perspective, and about how we've had really a very, very weak growth here in the U.S. They've pumped it up a little bit by redefining growth and GDP and other means. But, you know, it's been maybe half of what's historically normal. That's you know, been the record here. And in Europe and Japan, even worse. Okay, so Trump is a reaction to that. You know, the 99% who've gotten 5% of all the GDP income gains, right, and distribute amongst us, aren't happy. And, you know, in different parts of the country, they're even less happy than the average unhappy, right? And that, of course, is the industrial Middle West and places like that. And that's how they vote, you know, why they, anybody but, you know, the people and elites in Washington who have been there, you know, let's put Trump in office. We don't care. We don't like him, but send a signal. Okay, so Trump is a reaction to a crisis here since in the last decade or so, an inability to get the U.S. and global economy going again. But he's not the first in that regard. If you look back in history, our history, recent history, right, this Trump attempt to restructure the system is really replicating other attempts to do that as well. Nixon, in the early 1970s, came up with a series of programs and policies which were designed to deal with the crisis at that time. Ronald Reagan, again, in the early 80s, the stagnation and crisis of the 1970s. These are the origins of what we sometimes call neoliberalism, right? And then a weaker form of this, the congressional reflection of another attempt to enact change called the Contract with America in the early 1990s, which followed the U.S. housing and savings and loan crash in the late 80s and the recession of in 1990-92. The Contract with America, you know, is a movement in 19 comes to the surface in Congress and the House in 1994 when the right wing takes 54 seats away from the Democrats. We hadn't seen that big of a debacle until 2010 and 16, where the Democrats have another debacle. Okay, so you know, the corporate elites periodically restructure the system in order to deal with foreign competitors and domestic challengers, and both. And you know, it's not just since the 1960s-70s with Nixon, Reagan, and Gingrich, but it's it goes back even before that. A big restructuring in 1944-47 as the U.S. capitalists come out on top of the world, right? And things change. International Monetary System, IMF, and all these things. The dollar, big changes. But even in World War One. Period, big changes as well as the U.S. elites began to realize that they can take a step onto the global stage of colonialism here and compete with the Europeans. And the U.S. prepared to do so, passed the income tax, passed the Federal Reserve, and so forth. These were all preparations for the U.S. taking a bigger role in the 1920s. And, of course, the 1944-47. And then we have a crisis brewing in the late 60s, where European competitors were challenging the U.S. And winning back markets in Europe and U.S. from U.S. Businesses. The dollar was appreciating, making U.S. companies not competitive, and we had big challenges domestically going on as well. What were the challenges domestically in the U.S. at the time? People aren't aware, but American workers and unions had the second biggest strike wave in U.S. history in 1969-71 and ended up winning big time. settlements of 20-25% increases in wages and benefits. You know, you're lucky if you get 2% now in the unions, right? But 20-25% gains, well, you know, unions were so well organized and they still had something of a militant attitude. Strikes were going on all the time back then. I know, I was there. Today you barely hear of a strike anywhere, you know. Unions are just, you know, with their hat out saying, please give us something, most of them, right? And don't know even know how to fight anymore, even if they would want to. mass social movements at the time, environmentalists, women, minorities were all expanding social legislation like job safety and health laws, and other laws were being passed. So there was a challenge from the bottom up in the U.S. to the ruling elites and the corporations, as well as domestically from abroad. Well, Nixon responded with what he called the New Economic Program in 1971, which was a program and measures designed to rearrange the relationships, competitive relationships with foreign competitors, particularly Europeans, and at the same time to stop and check union gains and roll back union gains and bargaining and strikes and so forth, and to do something about the protesters, right? This was called the NEP, the New Economic Program, in August 1971. It's not coincidental at the same time that what was written within a week was called the Powell Memorandum. I don't know if you know, listeners know the Powell Memorandum, but it was really about how to roll back democracy and the challenges from below here in the United States, and how corporations and businesses, capitalists, could take over again, take back their government, you see. The two go hand in hand, not coincidentally. You know, Powell becomes this guy Powell, you know, in the government, and later gets paid off with a Supreme Court position. Okay, so the NEP, right, in 1971, the U.S. dollar was devalued, which made U.S. corporations more competitive, right? And the post-war international monetary system called Bretton Woods was imploded purposely by Nixon, right? Well, Trump today wants to force foreign competitors to raise the value of their currencies, you know, which in effect devalues the dollar. You know, instead of devaluing the dollar, force them to raise the value of their currencies. You know, he talks about currency manipulation and so forth. That's what it's all about. Raise your currencies, which make U.S. goods, exports goods cheaper, and therefore our companies can take back part of the pie that you guys have accrued over the years, right? So a dollar devaluation simply by another means, right? Nixon imposed a 10% import tax. Well, that's not unlike Trump's proposed 20% border tax, is it? It'll probably end up a 10% border tax, right? Very, very, the tax, the tariff, virtually the same here, right? The devaluation virtually the same. Nixon proposed subsidies and tax cuts for U.S. auto companies and other manufacturers. Well, Trump has been going around talking to Ford, Carrier, Boeing, and others, saying the same in exchange for token statements from them that they'll reduce their offshoring of jobs, not stop or reverse, you see, but slow it down and make some announcements about jobs here in the U.S. Makes it look like, you know, he's bringing these people to heel. Well, he's not bringing them to heel. He's promising them more in terms of big corporate tax cuts coming and other subsidies if they will agree to make announcements about bringing some of the jobs back. You see, they're going to end up net beneficiaries, right? It's the same thing with the big pharma companies that are gouging everybody with their drug price increases, right? Well, Trump meets with them, and he pretty much says, oh, lower your price. So they make it some token move to lower the price on a couple drugs. But, Trump says at the same time, we're going to accelerate the approval process for your new drugs, even if it kills some people. Mm-hmm. So, oh, okay, yeah, we'll sell more. You know, we'll bring down the price because you're going to allow us to cut our costs somewhere else. So there's all this quid pro quo stuff going on in these agreements that you don't hear about. And he's not forcing them. He's giving them a carrot. There's no stick here. It's a carrot. Okay, Nixon in 71 introduced a 7% investment tax credit for businesses to stimulate business spending in the U.S. Well, Trump's going beyond that, talking about multi-trillion dollar tax cuts for businesses and investors, while saying that tax cuts for business is needed to create jobs. Well, Republicans have been saying that since 2001. Tax cuts create jobs. Well, there's no empirical causal evidence that that's the case. None. Zero. Zip. That tax cuts create jobs. Now, they're not telling you that, but everything they say is tax cuts create jobs. You know, they create this impression of people that if you give businesses more money, they're going to spend it and create jobs here in the U.S. No, they may spend it and create jobs offshore. They may just hoard it. Right? They may give it back in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. They may do all that. They may send it offshore, the money, and just hoard it in their offshore subsidiaries like Apple does. Right? It doesn't mean you cut their costs. They're going to automatically spend it. That's a fallacy of contemporary economic theory. And people believe that. Cut business costs, they'll spend it. No, they'll do all these other things. They won't spend it. And that's true whether you cut costs on their interest charges, you know, let them borrow money cheap, or you cut costs by deregulating them, or you cut their costs by giving them tax cuts. None of these cost-cutting things necessarily mean it's going to result in investment in jobs. Lots of things can happen in between, you see. But this fiction is created, you know, by our economic discipline here, tax cuts create jobs. It's ideology, it's not economics. Well, Nixon froze union wages, you know, I said a minute ago, 20-25%, and then rolled them back. The 20% contract gains were reduced by Nixon to 5.5%. That's it. Rolled back. We had a 90-day wage freeze, and all those contracts that had won 20-25% were rolled back to 5.5%. Well, you know, Trump brings in his building trades fellows and, you know, strokes them at the same time. You know, he's promoting, encouraging state-level right-to-work movements and business legislation that will outlaw having members who have unions outlaw automatically joining the unions or paying dues. In other words, you can have a union, but, you know, you don't have to support your union, right? Yeah, be effective union. Well, you got that all throughout the South. You got 20, more than two dozen states that have a right to work, and the unions are decimated as a result and can't get going as a result. That's part of deunionization, right? And they're, of course, when you know you don't have people who are joining up, even though the union's there, you can't negotiate very good agreements, right? Another parallel here. Nixon accelerated defense spending while refusing to spend money on social programs. Even though those programs were passed by Congress, he impounded the funds, wouldn't spend it. Well, Trump just announced an historic 9% increase in defense spending, almost 10, right? While proposing to gut spending on education, health, social programs by the same amount. All right, similarity then, there, on defense spending and social cuts. All right, similarities between Nixon and Trump are abound in the political realm as well. For example, Nixon fought and railed against the media. Trump's doing the same thing. Only difference is one used the telephone, the other the iPhone. Nixon declared he had a mandate, and the silent majority of middle America was behind him. Well, Trump has this, quote, forgotten man of the middle America that put him in office, he says, right? Nixon bragged construction worker hard hats were backing him, and they were directed to attack the anti-war demonstrators and so forth. At the same time, he encouraged construction companies to form their anti-union construction industry roundtable that ended up gutting the construction unions over the next couple of decades. Well, Trump welcomes the construction unionists to his White House, but he supports reducing prevailing wage for construction work. You know, Nixon continually promoted law and order. He was a law and order president and attempted to repress social movements and protests by means of what was called the COINTELPRO program, where FBI, CIA spying on citizens was widespread. And he was developing plans in his second term to intensify repression of protesters and social movements, but of course he got impeached before that. But there's all kind of evidence to that. Well, Trump tweets, the police can do no wrong, right? He loves them second only to his generals. And he calls for new investigations of protesters, mandatory jail sentences for protesters, right? And encourages governors to propose new repressive legislation to limit the exercise of First Amendment rights of free assembly. This is Trump, law and order Trump. Same thing, goes back to Nixon, right? Trump is calling for an investigation of election voting fraud. Well, it's really a cover to keep the movement going at the state level to limit voters' rights. And the Trump Attorney General here, Sessions, is already pulling out of all these cases at the state where states, Republican states, have limited voting rights. Then the government, federal government, is no longer a friend of the defendants here in these cases. Nixon undertook a major shift in U.S. policy, establishing relations with communist China, which was a move designed to split the Soviet Union, Russia, from China. Well, Trump is just flipping that Nixon strategy around, attempting to establish better relations with Russia as a preliminary to intensifying attacks on China. Okay. Anticipating defeat in Southeast Asia, Nixon declared victory in Vietnam and walked away. Trump's going to do the same in Syria and Iraq. Watch. Nixon was a crook, and Trump will be revealed as a crook as well. But not until they release his taxes and identify payments, emoluments as it's called in the Constitution, received by his businesses from foreign governments and security services. And you know, the established elite Republican Party will not do anything until it gets its big tax cuts, deregulation, and you know, the clouds are cleared that we're going to keep bilateral free trade. Well, we have similarities as well with Reagan and Trump, just as we do with Nixon and Trump. Reagan introduced a major increase in defense spending when he came into office, including building a 600-ship navy, more missiles, nuclear warheads, and a new military front in space called Star Wars. Well, Trump loves his generals and has promised them 9%, 10% increase in war spending, you know, paid for by social program cuts. Well, that's very Reagan-esque of him. Reagan introduced a $700 billion tax cut for business investors in 81. That included more generous investment tax credits and accelerated faster depreciation allowance, which are tax credits, than even Nixon. Well, Trump is promising to do the same. Cut business tax rates by half. End all taxes on their offshore profits. Allow them to keep the $2 trillion they stuff offshore. And all inheritance taxes, keep offshore tax loopholes, more than $6 trillion worth. Oh, at the same time, he's eliminating tax credits on middle-income wage earners. Yeah, very Reagan-esque. Reagan cut social spending by tens of billions. Trump has proposed even more. Watch his budget. Reagan promised to balance the U.S. budget, but gave us accelerating annual budget deficits, fueled by record defense spending and tax cuts for businesses, more than $700 billion, on a GDP of $4 trillion at the time, proportionally even greater than what Bush did and even what is being proposed here by Trump. Largest cuts, tax cuts, business tax cuts in U.S. history, right? Well, Trump's proposing $6 trillion, much of that tax cuts for businesses and investors. Reagan's trade policy, designed to reverse deteriorating U.S. trade, in other words, once again, as under Nixon, foreign capitalists were cutting into U.S. Control in their markets and so forth. Japan and Europe. Now it was Japan more than Europe, right? Well, Reagan's whole policy was to directly attack Japan and Europe, force them in bilateral negotiations to raise the prices on their goods, inflate their economies and cause inflation, raise the prices on their goods, which would make U.S. goods and businesses more competitive. This was solidified in trade deals called in 1985 called the Plaza Accord with Japan and the Louvre Accord with Europe, right? Forced them to reevaluate, to increase the value of their currency, which means U.S. dollar would decline in value, make U.S. companies more competitive, right? Well, today we got Trump doing the same thing, except the targets are different. Now they're Mexico, Germany, and China, right? Each will have its own accord deal with Trump. The first free trade agreement with Canada was signed under Reagan. And, of course, Trump is a free trader. He just wants to rearrange the deck chairs on the free trade Titanic, replacing multilateral free trade with bilateral deals he negotiates and personally claims credit for. Right. Reagan encouraged speculators, corporate buyout kings, right, to take over companies and steal workers' pension plans, right, and shifted the burden of Social Security taxes onto workers, by raising the Social Security payroll tax to create a surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund, which happened, which the government then borrows every year, you see, and allows them to cut taxes as a result on corporations and spend the money, right, because they get this big pot here in the Social Security Trust Fund. They do the same thing by borrowing from abroad. Well, Trump promises not to cut Social Security, but he's refusing to say if the Republicans in Congress attach Social Security cuts to other legislation, whether he'll veto it. I think he won't veto it. He'll let it go through. And that's how he's going to, you know, slip by on that promise. Reagan deregulated banks, airlines, utilities, trucks, and other business, which led to the financial crises in the late 80s, early 90s. Well, Trump has repealed. Champion repeal of the Dodd-Frank bill, regulation bill, right? And has deregulated by executive orders more than even Reagan or Nixon in the first month in office. I mean, something like 36 executive orders, deregulations. Stock market, junk bond market, housing markets crashed in the wake of Reagan's financial deregulation. And so will the markets here with this Trump trade euphoria going on. Okay. Reagan bragged of his working-class Republican supporters and then turned around and busted unions like air traffic controllers. And Trump is his forgotten man and courts union leaders to the White House but pushes right-to-work laws and eliminating prevailing wage laws. Reagan replaced his chair of the Federal Reserve Bank, Paul Volcker, when he wouldn't go along with his plans for reducing rates. Well, Trump will do the same with Janet Yellen next year. And there are political parallels as well here. Even before the 1980 national elections, which Reagan won, Reagan's staff members were meeting secretly with foreign governments' representatives in Iran to request that they not release the 300 American hostages taken under Jimmy Carter, right, before the 1980 election. Yeah, they had these one-on-one, and this was even before the election. And nothing happened to them, but Trump, you know, his General Flynn here, right, talks to the Russians after the election, and he gets canned, right? Reagan's boys gets off, Flynn doesn't. But the events are similar, even though the outcome's different. Reagan attacked the liberal media, maybe less aggressively than Trump, right? But threatened the liberal public broadcasting company to change its tone. And which it did, right? Started inviting stopped inviting people left to center, and only centrists and rightists, right? And so did the mainstream media, Meet the Press, all those guys did the same thing. Well, Trump is attacking the media more aggressively, yes. Not trying to tame it, but to delegitimize it. And he's proposed to privatize the Public Broadcasting Corporation. Reagan's staff violated congressional laws at the time by arranging drug money seizures from Latin America by the CIA to pay for Iranian arms bought for the U.S. by Israel, which were then distributed to the so-called Contras in Nicaragua to launch a civil war against the left-wing government in Nicaragua. Right? Nixon has Watergate. This was called Irangate. Well, there's going to be a gate under Trump here before it's over, too. Reagan's offensive against the environment was notorious, including appointments of cabinet members who publicly declared their intent to dismantle the department and gut the budget. Well, Trump's on the same path. Nixon's policy, as we said, was to court China to put pressure on Russia. Reagan then courted Russia to isolate China. Well, Trump's policy now is going to return to a Nixonian, let's court Russia and confront China. See, they just keep flipping this stuff back and forth. Okay, so that's the situation we've got here. What's new is Breitbart. Trump has Breitbartified Nixon, Reagan programs and policies. Well, we don't have time to talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about Breitbart next week, because this is the new key here in the, you know, the whole Trump new strategy, Breitbart, and its positions of economic nationalism and others. We'll talk about that next week. Okay, this is Alternative Visions, and listen to our promos for our upcoming discussion with union activists here on what to do next. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.